sisters in the Dharma, last night has somewhat turned me inside out, so I'm feeling a tad doolally, but I'll do my best. And as a friend once said to me, Mutashri, you don't need to be perfect. Good enough is good enough. So I'll start with a quote from Tsongkhapa. All worldly things are brief, like lightning in the sky. This life you must know as a tiny splash of a raindrop, a thing of beauty, which disappears even as it comes into being. I've tried to put this talk into three sections. In part one, I want to share with you a little of how I learned that I had an hereditary illness and my responses to it. Part two follows out of part one and is very much to do with how I'm working with it. And the third part is drawing some of those strands together and expressing a little about how I see or experience the path to insight. So, people see me walking around and they think I'm very well. And indeed, at the moment, I am. I am very well. I'm very active, doing all sorts of things in and out of East London. There is no obvious sign that I'm unwell. It's an insidious matter. There is no pain. I find this quite difficult as well. In my early 20s, I had a lot of kidney infections, and eventually I was discharged from the hospital. Things were fine. But I do remember that my father died when I was age 3, and somewhere later on I learnt that it was because of renal failure. He was an active sportsman, an active engineer, had lots of friends, lots of loves and passions, swimming of which was one, cycling and pole vaulting. And one day he came home for lunch, as he always did. And I always ran around to the front gate because it would bang as he pushed his bike in. And he would pick me up and give me a tight hug, with holding me in the crook of his arm, as it were, and park his bicycle. And we would go round together, me in his arms and him going towards my mother. And he would kiss mother and they'd have a hug, and he still had me in his arms. And then he'd put me down. And if I felt that I needed a bit more of his attention, I would say, Daddy, mother hasn't given me my coddy today, my cod liver oil. And that would get me what I needed. However, one day he came home and the door banged, but he didn't pick me up. And it was strange. I heard my mother saying to him, oh, please don't go back to work. And he said, oh, well, I'll be all right, I'll go back. He works as an engineer at the only factory in St. Kitts at that time and still. And a few minutes late, he left, going back to work, and about 10 minutes or so later, it seemed very quick to me as a 3-year-old, he came through the door being supported by one of my uncles. I was sent to play in another room. I was looking out at the mountain, Mount Misery, in St. Kitts, and someone ran through the gate very, very quickly. I heard a scream, and apparently my father had died. So with this condition, you can go on for years not knowing that there's anything wrong. My brother, about maybe 10 years ago, 12 years ago, also died of renal. Well, it wasn't because of renal failure, but because he was on dialysis, he picked up one of those kidney bugs, one of those awful anti-resistant bugs, and subsequently died of renal failure. Prior to that, I watched the pain he suffered, knowing, and this is so important for me to take in, knowing that he would never get a transplant. He would never get a kidney transplant. He had to come to terms with this, watching a white peer of his receive a transplant and began to live his life in the way that he had before. The reason why there are no transplants for people of my colour is that not enough people of African, Asian, Caribbean descent are offering organs for donor. And so they have now stopped, as I understand it, using the kidneys, the donor kidneys of white people for people of my background, for people of my ethnic background, because the body initially accepts the transplant and 99% of the time rejects it thereafter. So a kidney is lost. So it was very painful for me as an older sister watching my brother come to terms with all of this. And to some extent, this is my position now. However, I am fortunate, very fortunate. My father died in 35, my brother died at 40, and here I am at 60, standing here before you, looking very well. And have been very well for some time. My main ailment was insomnia, and for several years now I sleep well. So I lead a very full and active life. However, I do take a small amount of medication at several times during the day, and that is a real crux for me. It's a real teaching point. Because I am forced to reflect that I have this condition, I now have 15 to 20% of kidney function in total left, and I'm doing pretty well. You know, I've lived, I'm the longest liver on my father's side of the family. So as I take this medication, I reflect on my condition. But I also reflect on the fact that I could die tomorrow of something completely different, and that it's really important that I don't become overly concerned about having this condition, having this illness. But it's also leading me to practice very differently, because I want to make good use of this precious opportunity to practice wholeheartedly, with real commitment. Yes, I'm trying, but I think I could do better. I feel very fortunate that I found the Dharma as elucidated by Sangharakshita. It suits my temperament, and I'm not particularly sophisticated. I need something fairly straightforward. So for all the time I've been in the movement, I practice the mindfulness of breathing and the metta bhavana. I still do that, and I do my sadhana, usually the Manjugosha sadhana. And I'm pleased to say that for the second time since I've had this sadhana, I've completely and utterly fallen in love with him once again. It's a wonderful experience, because one just wants to give him one's all. And I am doing that at the moment, and long may the love affair last. It doesn't mean that I don't have difficulties or find meditation sometimes trying when I feel I'm not getting anywhere with it. But on the whole, I'm happy with how that practice is going, my meditation practice is going. And my confidence in the order, the confidence in my friends, the people with whom I live, is deepening too. I live with 11 other people. It's interesting living with a lot of people, because one is sorely challenged. Certainly I'm sorely challenged. And I'm opening up myself to more and more challenge. I want to be seen. And I want to deepen my friendship based on people seeing me rather than having imaginings as to who I am and how I am. So I want to say something about the practices that I do and how I lead my life. My life is my practice. Most mornings I rise early, about 6:30, and I garden for half an hour, 45 minutes. And it's a great practice, because I'm having to look at detail, yet bearing the overall picture in mind. I'm very, very fortunate to live in a place where I have so much space in which I can garden. Then I go in to meditate. I have phases where I meditate alone and phases where I meditate with the community. Currently, I'm meditating with the community. When I meditate, prior to meditating, I commit myself to the practice and I bring Bhante to mind. He has never claimed to be perfect, and I wouldn't know perfection if I saw it anyway. So I bring him to mind, and I bring my preceptors, Sangadevi, my private preceptor, and Ratnasuri, my public, and I start the practice with a verse which takes all living beings to account, into account, with the Buddha at the front, the Shakyamuni, Bhantis, teachers, and so on and so forth, right down to me here sitting. And I do this because I'm finding that it helps me to connect with others, others I know and others I don't know. So as I say at the moment, I'm meditating with others. I like collective practice, but I need to practice alone as well. After breakfast, depending on how my meditation practice has gone, and invariably it goes, I feel inspired by it, sometimes satisfied and delighted, other times, well, not much has happened here. But more often than not, I breakfast alone. Breakfast is a very important part of my day. It's my main, it's the point at which I create most space after breakfast. So breakfast is essential. And I eat mindfully. I really do. I enjoy the tastes. I enjoy the smells of the food, the orange, the apricots. And I enjoy looking at what I'm eating. And all this sitting in front of the garden. I feel fortunate. I can make my own food. I can prepare my own food, and I can eat it without assistance. I am fortunate. It's also a time when I do reflect on what's coming up for the day. So I'm trying to start a writing practice, so I'm gathering my thoughts, and to do that I go to my room and make notes. And then whatever follows, follows. There are, however, a couple of practices that I've been doing around the community, apart from the garden. Coming in from breakfast and outside, there is usually a lot of, often things which aren't washed, dishes which aren't washed, and always things which aren't stacked, and they look as though they're really going to fall apart. So I've decided, and I just do it quietly, I do have a moan sometimes, because sometimes it's a bit overwhelming, but I've just decided to do things for others without a song and dance, generally. So I decide to do a certain amount of the washing up, depending on time, and sometimes I do all of it. And then I decide, too, that I would just clear two or three things from the draining rack, which aren't mine. Now, all this may seem quite simple, but it's one of the ways in which I try to build to attenuate that subject-object duality, that sense that these people are not wanting a servant who've left all these dishes there, that they're in a hurry. And I have a bit more time, perhaps, than they do. So I try to offer myself by doing that and just noticing as I'm doing it what the mental state is behind doing it. So that's one of the things I do. Then at some point in the day, I go out for a walk. Maybe I have an errand to do. I almost always pause before I go onto the road. I know I take three breaths, and then I go out onto the road. So I'm trying to continue that practice of mindfulness as I go out. And again, sometimes I can lose it within footsteps. Two or three footsteps, it's gone, and I stop, and then I start again. I'm very fortunate to have a good chapter. I mean, this path, Sila Samadhi Prajna. And one of the things that Bhante has provided for us is he's given us all the things that he didn't have. He didn't have a chapter. He's been like the good parent. He didn't have a chapter. He only had one friend, and it took him to get to Kalimpong to meet Dado Rinpoche. And I have so much. And it's what he has provided. I didn't create it. He created these institutions. And so I try my best to participate in them as much as I can. So these are just some of the practices I do. Recently I went to see Bhante. And as we were talking, I said to him, there was a pause, and I said, "You know, Bhante, I've been meditating for 30 years now. I've been ordained nearly 20. And I thought I'd be at least, you know, on the way to enlightenment by now." And he looked at me very hard, and he said, "Mudita Shri, you had a view of how you'd be." And I stopped. Because, yes, I don't have a measure intake as to how I am and how I'm doing. But what I do have, and I urge us to have, is confidence in what we've been given. We've been given far more. I've been given far more than I realise. And what I want to do with it is to engage as deeply as possible with it. As deeply as possible. And to be consistent. I don't feel a need to look anywhere else, but I appreciate those who do. And in fact, I benefited from those who've gone elsewhere, in particular people like Prakasha, Karmala Sheila. I've had many meditation teachers in the order, in the movement. But for me, the simple, straightforward practices of mindfulness, metta, and sadhana, and taking those out into the world, beyond the confines of my community and the centre, it feels like that's more than enough for me. And all I want to do with what's left of my life is to engage consistently, wholeheartedly, and deeply with what I've been given. What Bhante has given me. And what, as a result of my father's death, his untimely death, led me and my mother to come to England, as a result of which I found the Dharma. I've been given the tools to live a truly human life, a truly human life with all of you here and with all the practices and institutions that Urgyen Sangha Ratchita has open-handedly offered to me. Thank you.